Welcome to Trailblazers, where we explore the inspiring journeys of entrepreneurs and industry leaders who are redefining success and making a lasting impact. These game changers are driving progress in our region and around the world. I'm Melody Bradford, your host. Welcome to Trailblazers. In this episode, we spotlight a leader who is shaping the community, challenging convention, and leaves places better than she found them. She is quite literally helping design the future of our region. Becky Bradley is the executive director of the Lehigh Valley Planning Commission, where she helps guide smart growth, regional collaboration, land use, transportation planning, and long-term visioning for one of Pennsylvania's fastest growing regions. She leads in a field historically dominated by men, navigates complex public-private dynamics, and balances big picture vision with real world impact, all while keeping the Lehigh Valley's people, places, and the future at the center of the conversation. This is a conversation about leadership, resilience, planning with purpose, and what it really takes to shape a region. Becky, welcome to Trailblazers. It is an absolute pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you.
Becky, what first sparked your interest in planning and public service, and how did you begin your professional journey?
Planning I came to in an interesting way. I actually have an undergraduate degree in historic preservation, and I really like the idea of, why are these buildings here, and like, what can we do to protect them, but how can we bring in new development? But I didn't really know like what that meant. And so I went to Southeast Missouri State University for undergrad. It's where my great grandmother went to college, like back in the 1800s.
Oh, wow.
But yeah. And so I come from a long line of educated women. And, you know, when I got there, I realized that research methods and understanding information and how that informs community and the life cycle of communities over time was something I was interested in. So when I graduated, I was like, what am I going to do? I wasn't really sure. And there was a job open. Actually, it was a six-month, seven-month like work internship with the lieutenant governor at the state of Illinois, working in their Main Street program. And that helped communities that were seeing significant change all across the state figure out how to revitalize their community. And I absolutely loved it. And that's how I found planning. Did I know I was going to be in the public sector? No. I knew about the public sector. My dad was an elected police commissioner in a small village called Jerome, which is surrounded by the city of Springfield in Illinois, where I'm from.
So was that particular community, a couple questions come to mind based on your answer, but was that particular community anything like the Lehigh Valley?
No.
So it was different.
Yeah, totally different. It was like a post-World War II kind of community where the homes were really close together, but they had big front yards and big backyards, a lot of single family detached. But we had a church and a municipal building. And the interesting thing about the Midwest is because a lot of the people are from other places, is if that's like the church in your neighborhood, doesn't matter how you were raised, that's the one you go to.
Right.
And it formed a real social structure for me. And I think that really influenced who I am, because I was hanging out with ladies that voluntarily taught the Sunday school, and they were teaching us not only just about religious things, but they were teaching us about life skills and teaching us about, you know, the community overall and friendship and kindness and what it meant to volunteer.
Mm-hmm. And so you said, you mentioned that your dad was the police commissioner. Did public service or being in service to the public, because you're not an elected official, right?
You hold
the executive director position as a hired individual. So did the prospect of public service scare you at all, or did you embrace it based on the community that you had there? And how did that change when you got here to the Lehigh Valley?
I met my husband after I got my planning degree, because after I left Illinois Main Street, to get a master's degree. I found planning in that job. Mm-hmm. I went to the University of Pennsylvania, and there at the time at the Graduate School of Design, it's the Weitzman School of Design now, and I got my master's degree in planning. And I met my husband not long after I graduated, and he's from the Lehigh Valley. And we joke that he's part of the Pennsylvania Dutch dynasty because we live in an area that his family has been part of since like the 1730s.
Wow.
Right. So I was walking into a place that had, you know, very, very deep roots in a rural community, which, by the way, where I'm from in central Illinois, my mom's family still farms to this day. So I had deep agricultural roots as well. But I'm living in this beautiful area, but it's not flat. There's a mountain and there's a lot of hills. And it was really interesting to me. And that idea of that sense of place and the land forming the values and the sensibilities of the people was interesting to me. And they felt, and in some cases still do, threatened by development in certain parts of the Lehigh Valley because they are legitimately mm-hmm. agricultural communities, yet this place is gorgeous mm-hmm. and everybody wants to be here. So that idea of helping communities, it didn't matter to me whether it was through the private sector or the public sector, was really what I wanted to do. And that's when I found the planning position at the City of Easton. And then the rest is history.
Well, and urban and regional planning has traditionally been a male-dominated field. Yeah. What drew you into that space despite that? I mean, we talked a little bit about like where you came from and how you decided to take that position. But did that ever cross your mind? This is a male-dominated field. I'm going to have to – I might face some challenges, so to speak. Did you feel that dynamic early in your career?
Not really, interestingly enough. I found out what it meant, you know, when I was on the job. But most people are people. Mm-hmm. And there are so many women and men in my life that have been mentors to me. Sal Panto, the current mayor of the city of Easton, is one of those folks. My first boss, Donna Harris, who, you know, gave me Jane Jacobs' book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, and says, read this, you're a planner. And I was like, I was very scared of her, by the way. She's tough. She's like from a New Yorker. She was out in Illinois, and here I am from like, you know, Kansas. You know? I'm from Illinois, but it looks like Kansas in right. The Wizard of Oz, you know, like I'm like the Dorothy, right?
Yeah.
Like rainbows and unicorns. And but I learned from people being tough, whether they were men or women, because they saw the potential in a place or a situation. And ultimately, I felt like I needed to rise to that challenge. And I think you could have that no matter who you are. I mean, sure, you're going to encounter various things along the way, but it should never stop you from the goal of helping other people and being part of something that's bigger than yourself.
Sure, sure. So, you know, I heard, and I won't say which elected official it was, but I heard that the planning test, I guess it is extremely difficult.
Yep.
And there's like a 0% pass rate on the first time and no one does. You know, the elected official that actually shared this was pretty stoic and thought that they were definitely going to pass it and didn't, right? And kind of humbled that elected official. I won't say who that is, but in any event, first of all, how'd you do on the test? You know, like how many tries did it take? That's my first question.
One.
Okay, go on, boy.
One. Okay. I had to pay for it.
Did you?
And I had like $0. I had some serious student loan debt after UPenn. Not going to lie. And, you know, I was on my own, right? So I had saved up my money for a year to take that test. There was no way that I was going to fail.
And there's not like a Cliff Note version.
No. You know? I mean, now there's all sorts of tools and practice tests and things. But back then, you had to like drive to Lancaster at like 5 a.m. and get there for this once a year. Like, hey, these people took the test last year. Here's the type of questions that are on it. Like a half day session. And then there's this book that I'm not kidding is probably like 4 or 5 inches thick.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
called The Green Book. I actually don't know what the real title of it is, but it's basically like a local government planning manual. Mm. And you have to memorize that thing. You have to know Supreme Court cases and Pennsylvania court. I mean, it's just really, really intense because that's what planning is, really, really intense.
Right.
And they want to make sure that you understand how government functions, the powers of government, where planning fits into that, but then also the legal
engineering
framework.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Everything.
Yeah,
like
everything.
Everything in between.
Yep.
And it's like probably – I actually heard it was like harder than a bar exam test.
Yeah. They call it the planning bar. Yeah. And once you have that American Institute of Certified Planners, they call it AICP certification, you don't ever want to lose it. And so not only is it the test, but you have a commitment to giving back to the profession, giving back to your community, and also staying current. Mm. And so there's all sorts of over 30 hours of training requirements that you have to put in every year to maintain that certification.
Mm-hmm. Are there any particular challenges that you faced along the way? And did you have any specific mentors?
Well, I think everybody faces challenges. I want to say the biggest one was when I started at the city of Easton, it was not in a great place. And I think I was there maybe less than 6 months. Mm. And the city was working with the state to do basically like a pre-bankruptcy planning.
Mm.
And I'm like, wow, I just started a job and the place has some real financial constraints. What can I do? What can my department do? You know, planning and codes to help the city get out of that, right? Like, what's our bucket of water that we have to carry to fill that fountain in Center Square to make this thing work?
Mm-hmm. And what year was that?
Oh, 2005.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a while ago. And I don't think any of us knew exactly how we were going to get through that. But the beautiful thing was is that at the time, Mayor Phil Mittman and City Council and then Sal Panto, who came in as mayor afterwards, they were open to ideas, right? Like they knew they had to build a team. And so they came as mentors. And I think that's good. And I mean, I wasn't even 30 at the time. So they put a lot of trust in all of us that were working in the city. And Sal in particular hired a bunch of young people. Honestly, we had all had a lot of book knowledge, but none of us really had the experience. And he said, look, we don't have any money, but if you go raise it to go after a good idea, we'll figure out in the administration and on council how to back it. And they did exactly that, Sal mm-hmm. and the various councils that I got to work for. And that's how we really started to revitalize the city. Acquired the Simone Silk Mill, which is, you know, just a wonderland. Acquired the land that's the Carl Sterner Arts Trail. By the way, I had to manage the construction of that, which I had never... I had managed the construction of a garden in my life, but not like a real place. And Joe Morrow, the former city engineer, he's like, I can help you. And he was like this quiet force, you know, behind me, along with Dave Hopkins, who's still the public works director, saying, you know what, you got this. And I think that's the beauty of it, is that whole culture and all of those people I named and many, many more. Jeff Warren, who's now on Northampton yes. County Council, yeah. he was on City Council. Like, he and I are about the same age. We're like, we're just going to roll up our sleeves and figure this
Get
thing out,
yeah.
right? But there were so many people, regardless of how old they were, that said, we can do this. Like, the idea is good enough. We were able to raise the funds or most of the funds to do these things, and it became transformative. So we were just building the foundation and pulling together to do it. And what I learned from that experience that's very valuable to me as a planner is you can't plan everything.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, you can say, this is a good idea and let's plan how to raise the money and how to figure out how to do it. But there are so many challenges along the way. And learning to be flexible and rely on each other, I think, was one of the most valuable lessons I learned from my time there.
And you now lead a regional organization that works still across, you know, municipality sectors and political lines. How would you describe your leadership style?
I like to get in there too. You know, I do. But also, I'm surrounded by literal geniuses. They're building like entire models to model the region's traffic. They're doing policy work and building community collaborations that are so deep and complicated yet supportive. It's incredible. And so my role now, because we've doubled the size of the staff since I've been there, which is about a little over 12 years now, it was different at the upfront. When there's like 12, 13 people in an office, you can just kind of like yell over the cubicle, like, hey, you got that? Hey, what do you want to do about that? But now we have to have structure, right? Because we're doing more projects, more people. And so a lot of it now is coaching, mentoring, making sure they have the resources, but also that they can come to me as a professional and be like, hey, I'm not sure where this should go. Or, oh, I've got these like six ideas. I think all of them are good. Can we talk about how we can weave all of these into a strategy that increases housing supply? And so in many ways, it's me listening, if that makes sense, and supporting them and providing guidance where I need to as a planner. Plus, I mean, the truth is we run a completely independent government agency. Mm-hmm. So I'm also in the finances and insurance and all of those things that make it work, which is similar to a small business.
And that actually leads me to my next question. Planning often involves balancing long-term vision and immediate community concerns. How do you manage that tension as a leader and other tensions that you come up against on a daily basis? Because I know you do.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I think the key is being able to like rely on our LVPC officers or the officers of the Lehigh Valley Transportation City, because sure, it's one organization, but we have two separate boards with two separate sets of bylaws that work under very different laws. And so it's a matter of, you know, talking to the folks that are also experts, not just inside the organization, but that are our leadership on our boards, as well as people out in the community, and trying to get them to come to our meetings and be part of the collaboration or us going to them, right? So I think that multi-way dialogue is key, but you're going to hear things that conflict a lot. Mm-hmm. So the key that I think is data always beats drama. Mm-hmm. If we can start with a place where we have facts and we approach it from an optimistic platform, I call that fact-based optimism, we can negotiate anything and we can pivot when we need to. And sometimes it is like a negotiation that might not be friendly. And other times it's like, okay, folks, if we do this, this is going to happen. If we do this, these things could happen. And what are we okay with in terms of a risk profile? But you're constantly reassessing your priorities because the world's changing that fast, especially with AI and some of the other things that are actually making us faster and more efficient, which is a really good thing in a lot of ways, but also, you know, what are the vulnerabilities to the communities associated with that?
Interesting you said that. You mentioned AI, and I wonder what influence that will have going forward. Last night I was on social at the very, very end of the evening, and I noticed some sort of AI rendering of the Jordan Park House or Jordan Creek House that right there in Whitehall, right before you get to 145, and it's this gorgeous home that has this, you know, these fantastic bones, it looks like, but it's, you know, it's been left vacant and whatever else. And I've been looking at that house for probably 20 years and thinking, gosh, when is somebody going to do something about that? So it's interesting to see, like, you know, how AI is going to influence that. Have you seen any of that yet, that people bring something and say, I want to do this based on AI?
Yeah, all the time. And we're doing a lot of it internally. It's saved us hundreds of thousands of dollars in just the last 10, 11 months.
Wow.
Buying traditional old software systems that might not have been as accurate as if we just built our own closed AI model using Microsoft Copilot. We can code faster now. We can do all of these things. And so actually we just released the most accurate population and employment projections we've ever ever released.
Based on AI.
Based on AI.
Wow.
But we don't use, like, we don't go to ChatGPT and be like, hey, how fast is Lehigh Valley's population going to grow?
Yeah.
Though we did do that to see what that answer would be compared to, like,
what
the,
it actually
the statistical
was.
Yeah. model that we built using AI, right? But the cool thing about it is when the census does their, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics does their interim updates, which they do about twice a year, all of that we can feed into the model and we can make it generative too. So we can, it's not now doing population employment projections every 4 years. Of course, you still want to do them every 4 years and look back to where you were, where have you come from, is this working, what has changed, because our communities, school districts, sewer and water authorities, businesses need to know what that is. But we can more quickly release that stuff out to the community.
And how close was ChatGPT to the actual, just out of curiosity?
It was less accurate, but it wasn't wildly inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
We don't, and this is going to sound so nerdy, but we don't accept anything that has a margin of error, you know, more than 3%.
Okay.
Right. It has to be statistically valid.
Sure.
Right. So not only do we have to build the AI model, but we had to test it, which means we had to do everything, I joke and say on paper, but in Excel to make sure that it worked with the model.
And so, you guys are a wonderful statistical hub for the Lehigh Valley,
yeah.
I have to say. You guys have all the data. Over the years, what lessons has leadership taught you that you wish you had known earlier in your career?
It's taught me, I think it was always curious, but it's taught me to be more curious and to learn how to ask better questions, because I think that's really what leadership is based off of, is understanding a situation and then being able to support the people that you're working with or advising. In the case of the LVPC, I mean, we're writing policy and making, you know, billions of dollars worth of transportation investments, utilizing funds that have been given to the region by mm-hmm. Congress and the state legislature to keep our mobility as high as we can make it. By the way, we need more money. But that we're growing so fast. But that aside, understanding how things work, being able to think through what those complex problems are, being able to report on that in a way that anybody can understand,
mm-hmm.
that requires a level of curiosity, persistence, ability to ask questions, and understand when you ask the wrong question, revise it, and ask it in a way that makes sense. And so that whole iterative process, I think, is really what leadership has taught me. It's also taught me that thinking ahead is imperative,
mm-hmm.
but thinking way ahead in the case of the LVPC, like, we have to live in the now, and we can talk about the next, you know, 3 to 5 years with very high degree of accuracy. But when you start going out 10, 20, 30 years, it's inherently going to be less accurate. So as a leader, how do you communicate what that future is going to be? How do you take policy goals, which are a lot of words, they're important words, they're very intentionally derived, but how do you take that and get people excited about it?
Mm-hmm.
Especially since there's a lot of people here. You're not going to get to everyone right away.
With differing agendas in
right.
some cases.
And that's where yeah. the persistence comes in too.
Mm-hmm.
And then getting the feedback from them and saying, okay, well, this part of the policy really did work 2 years ago, but now we know a lot more. This has changed. That's changed. And so we've got to go back to the table and we can determine what we want to keep and what we need to change. And I think that's really what leadership is about evolving. Not giving up, not quitting. And it's that level of caring that I think is critical to being effective.
And you've been recognized for your work in planning and regional leadership. Which professional recognitions or milestones have been most meaningful to you and why?
I think when I got the Tom Bradley, not related, by the way, Leadership Award from the National Association of Regional Councils, because it's a what I do across the country, right? So other executive directors, as well as elected officials that run regional councils or are on their boards. My colleagues telling me, like, you're really, really good at what you do. And it's kind of a lifetime achievement award. And I'm like, I'm not even done yet. Like, I'm still rolling up my sleeves and getting ready to go. I'm like, and people that are retiring get that award, right? And I'm kind of like, wow. And I'm hearing their stories, and they've had, you know, 30, 40 years of experience. And that was just, that was a really good one for me. And then I have one that's recent. This isn't an award, but this is an appointment. I never thought I would be into freight, but I had to kind of learn how to understand it here in the region, and freight mobility and the interaction of trains and trucks and airports and transit and all of these things, right? Now there's future forces with drones and other things, and autonomous vehicles are coming, and that'll affect freight deliveries and other things. But I got kind of into it when I saw all of the industrial development, and then we're advising on it as a commission to the communities themselves, but also to the public, to the developers, to the engineering community, to everybody. And I kind of just got into it, and I didn't realize it, but I was complaining a lot about the traffic calculation standards, which is run by the International Transportation Engineers, or ITE, and it's called the ITE manual that everybody uses. And I'm like, it's wrong for these types of industrial land uses. And I joked about it, and I talked about it like all over the country. This teaches you to keep your mouth shut too at the same time. But I got a call from somebody who I've known for a long time, a woman, one of the ladies of logistics, and said, hey, you're now a member of the LOLs. And I'm like, do I want to be? And she's like, yeah, sure. And I learned a lot from her too. Her name is Mary Grace Parker. She's with what used to be called the I-95 Corridor Coalition, which is now the Eastern Transportation Coalition. And she said, you know, I think you should really think about getting involved with the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine and their Transportation Research Board. And guess what? There might be an opportunity. And then another lady that I knew, also another LOL, because it's funny, you talked about there's not very many women in planning. There's even less women in freight and industrial transportation,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And so another lady that I had met through that, she called me and she said, I really think you'd be good for the intermodal multimodal freight committee. As a national committee where we actually get to advise, you know, people, state departments of transportation, and you're on there with some heavy hitters. It's like people that run state departments of transportation, people that run the logistics for UPS. Mm. I mean, and I just got appointed to that recently. We just had a first meeting. I went to D.C., and it's just an opportunity not only to serve our region but to serve the country and our freight mobility across the nation. And to me, that's just a tremendous honor, and I'm not going to let them down.
Okay, so two last questions, because we're coming up on the time. What do you believe great leaders owe the communities and partners they serve, and what makes the Lehigh Valley so special?
Great leaders owe the community integrity, right, in everything that they do, whether it's their work, but also their personal life and, you know, living what they talk about. I'm not a marketer. That's not what I do. I'm a thinker, but I'm also a doer. And I think that that translates into me as a person, too, and my incessant gardening and my incessant painting that I do.
And blueberry picking.
Yeah,
blueberry picking. Which we didn't even get to.
Yeah, I have a farm. It didn't set out to be that way, and it turned out. It just kept growing. But I think that's what we owe our community is you're giving so much of yourself, not only to now, but to the future. But you have to do that with intention and integrity.
And the last question I have, especially as we kick off this new year, is what is success to you?
I think success is balance, especially for the Lehigh Valley. So many things are happening, you know, 4,200 to 6,000 people coming in every year. And we're adding like an Emmaus borough, a city of Easton's worth of people, city of Bethlehem's worth of people, left and right. We have to have balance not only in our values, but balance in our implementation and make sure that we aren't giving up the things that really define who we are as a region.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Becky. It's been a pleasure. And your leadership reminds us that planning isn't just about maps or policies. It's about people, collaboration, and stewardship of place. The work you do today helps determine how future generations will live, move, and connect across the Lehigh Valley. To our listeners, keep blazing your trail.